You're listening to Audio Culture on 95 BFM.
Thanks to Audio Culture, Iwi Waiata, the Noisy Library of New Zealand Music. Go to audioculture.co.nz.
Ripper of a track, that is Suburban Reptiles with Megaton. You're listening to Audio Culture on 95BFM. I'm joined by Simon Gregg. Kia ora, Simon. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Yeah, good. Thank you. Thank you so much for joining me. We love Audio Culture and we have a very special segment today talking about Doug Rogers.
Yeah, it's a hell of a story. I mean, it's a story that I've long wanted to put on audio culture because it sort of wends its way through, it goes back to the late 1960s, and Doug Rogers is now one of the most successful music businessmen in the world.
Amazing. And this story that we're talking about today is in five parts on audio culture. So it's a bloody good effort from you, I reckon.
Yeah, well, it kind of started off as I was going to do it in two parts, but the thing kept on expanding. So that's where we got to. I don't think we could have told it any less than five parts.
Yeah, there's a lot to cover. I wasn't super familiar. I mean, obviously I'm familiar with a lot of Doug's work, but I wasn't familiar with him as a person having this much reach across the industry, so it's pretty fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, and the thing about Doug Rogers is he was kind of driven, I suppose, in a way, but he revolutionized at least the Auckland music industry for a while in the 1980s, and then he went on and did it again to the rest of the world.
Yeah,
And
amazing.
yeah, going from like a four-track recording studio in Auckland to a complex in Los Angeles where the Beach Boys recorded Pet Sounds and all that sort of stuff, plus his music software stuff, is an extraordinary story.
Yeah, I do love how you start the article in part one with kind of meeting him in the mid-2000s and then him taking over this huge building in the middle of Hollywood and kind of starting almost from scratch again in terms of like taking on a big project and really doing it up. And it's pretty inspirational, eh?
Yeah, totally, totally. And then about 6 months ago, I went and visited Doug, and I went to Los Angeles, and I got there before Trump arrived, thankfully. And then I stood in the middle of that studio, and you're standing there by the microphone where Frank Sinatra recorded "My Way,"
Oh my
and you walk
gosh.
into the next room, and you're standing where Brian Wilson stood in 1966 and recorded "Pet Sounds." It's mind blowing.
Yeah, incredible. Okay, I guess
But
we
the
should
great thing
probably
was,
start at the
sorry.
beginning, with Doug's sort of musical journey and how he came to Harlequin Studios as well, right?
Okay, well, Doug was a schoolboy in Whanganui. And as I say in the story, back in those days, Whanganui wasn't exactly the center of the world or even New Zealand's music industry. It was a provincial town. With a newspaper, and Doug went to the newspaper with his friend and said, "Can I do a column?" And he was, I suppose, 16, 15, 16 at the time. And he managed to talk the newspaper into a music column.
Wow.
And he then started using that to leverage his way into the record companies in Wellington, because in those days they were all based in Wellington. And
Amazing.
so by the turn of the 70s, he was working at HMV, later EMI, in Wellington. And moved to Auckland in about 1975, I think. And at that stage in Auckland, there were a couple of small studios, but most of the studios were kind of expensive and they were big and they were like 8-track or 16-track. And there were no little demo studios, really. I think there was one other one. And so Doug borrowed some gear off a couple of friends, a four-track recorder, found a space in Mount Eden Road, right next to where the power station is now, and put on a four-track studio. And overnight, he kind of made recording for young bands and young musicians affordable.
Wow, that's pretty amazing. It must have been, I mean, to just kind of set up like a studio on a whim, it must have been kind of scrambling to get all the parts together, I imagine.
Yeah, and those days, of course, we had import restrictions as well. So
Right.
you couldn't just go, "I want to get a four-track recorder or a 16-track recorder and have it shipped into the country and pay the GST." In those days, it was just you weren't allowed to do it. So they managed to find the gear, and he started recording at Harlequin in February, from memory, in February 1977. And I was involved in a band called the Suburban Reptiles. We just heard the song Megaton, their first single, and we were looking for somewhere to record. So I just went in there and said, "Can we record?" And the first single that was ever released with his name on it, the first single ever released out of Harlequin, was the Suburban Reptiles Megaton, which we just played.
Wow, how special. And so, like, as someone that was there during those early days of recording, what did it feel like to go into one of the first sort of, like, budget-friendly studios?
We kind of didn't really notice, I suppose. I mean, I think one of the things about punk when it arrived in New Zealand was you were breaking the rules anyway. So when we just thought, well, they're making records overseas, so we need to make a record. How do we do it? And that's what we did.
Cool.
And then it didn't occur to me until actually last year that we were the first record he'd ever released with his name on it. First record he'd ever released, full stop. And it was the beginning of a whole litany of connections I had with Doug.
Amazing.
So, excuse me. So then at the end of 1979, he decided that he wanted to move beyond the four-track in Mount Eden. And it had a few problems. There was a brothel upstairs, and they used to come out in the morning and find condoms all over the place outside. So that wasn't the best space. But then he found an old Hare Krishna restaurant in Albert Street. And the Hare Krishna people were moving somewhere else to High Street, I think, at the time. And so he took over the lease, and he went out, and this is what kind of typical Doug Rogers. He went to the bank and said, I want to borrow $500,000. Now, in 1979, $500,000 was not $500,000 as it is now.
Right.
You know, we're talking like a period when a house was $20,000.
Oh my gosh. Did they just laugh in his face?
Well, he managed to find assorted people who are willing to underwrite it. So there were a couple of fairly wealthy Wellingtonian families who said that they'd support him. And his then business partner had money behind her as well. So I think he got turned down by half a dozen banks. But eventually one of the finance companies, Marek Finance, said, okay, we'll do this. And they gave him $500,000.
Wow.
So he flew to Los Angeles and he tracked down a couple of guys in LA who were the top studio designers in LA and said, I've got this idea. And they flew down to New Zealand and they built the studio.
Oh my gosh, that's pretty amazing. He seems to just kind of like have this, there's like this underlying trait through the whole story and all five pieces of like, he just kind of gets an idea and then decides he's going to do it and then does it.
It's a risk. Yeah.
And it always works out.
And then so once he opened Harlequin 2 in Albert Street in, I think, once again, I'm trying to remember this sort of stuff, March or April 1980. So then I had another connection. I went in there and the first single that was released out of that was a record on my label. And the second single released out of that new studio was a record on my label as well. So we had that connection, which I hadn't realized at the time until last year. But Doug also did what he was doing at the previous studio, and he moved the budget recording thing, Midnight to Dawn things, across to the new studio. So what that did, when we all talk about AK-79 and the punk revolution and stuff as sort of very important moments in New Zealand's recording history, especially Auckland's, but the Harlequin Midnight to Dawns, which were $25 an hour, I think, meant that all those young bands that were coming out of the new band scene could record. So all of a sudden, in the early 80s, we had this music explosion.
Mm.
Yeah.
Amazing.
And it was critical. Yeah.
It's pretty impressive that, you know, he took this $500,000 loan and then still decided, even though he's got all this debt to pay off, no, I'm still going to make sure that the recording and the resources are accessible to young bands and up-and-comers, eh?
It is amazing. And I thought about that a little bit when I was writing the story. I suppose during the daytime he had the big budget stuff going through, a lot of advertising agency work and that sort of thing. But Doug said to me that the Midnight to Dawns paid his basic wages. They paid the engineers, they paid the... you know, just that sort of really basic stuff. But it also allowed him to train up his engineers.
Mm.
And which is, I mean, because we didn't have this history in Auckland, or in New Zealand, of having recording studios. There were only three or four big studios in the country. Then that meant we didn't have this like number of young engineers coming through. And if you're going to have an industry, you have to start training people up. So the next thing Doug decided to do was do a recording school. And he made it available. It's publicly available. You can subscribe to it and come and spend a few weeks there working with him and a couple of engineers and producers he'd brought in from overseas. Roy Thomas Baker, who produced Queen and The Cars and a lot of other things like that. He brought him down, and they spent several weeks training up young engineers, many of whom went on to record much of the stuff that was recorded in Auckland over the next decade or two.
Very cool. Okay, well, I think we should listen to a song from this sort of era of 1980. That's kind of where we're at with the Screaming Memes, correct?
Yeah, and this is one of the Midnight to Dawn tracks, which is why I chose it. So that was, I don't know how much it probably cost to record, $200 or $300
Wow.
to record. But we could only do it. This whole sort of scene sort of happened, and these sort of records started coming out. I mean, this is pretty rough, this record. But they started coming out because Doug made these Midnight to Dawn sessions available to us.
Okay, this is the Screaming Memes with Can't Take It. You're listening to Audio Culture 95 BFM. You say it's got that sort of DIY feel to it. It definitely does, but it's pretty impressive that they managed to do that for a couple $100 in a nice studio, eh?
Yeah, and it was a nice deal. It was a beautiful space. I mean, that was the one thing he did do very, very well. He made sure that it was a nice place to hang out, because and it had a out the front, it had a lounge room with a pool table and Space Invader machines and all that sort of stuff. So you could actually have it, you could go in there. Which could be it was also a downfall as well, because people would stand around all day playing games or playing snooker and stuff like that, rather than recording. which is something we sort of succumbed to as well. So with the Mimes, after we'd recorded Can't Take It, we went and re-recorded See Me Go, which Doug produced, co-produced it, and it was the very first New Zealand single to go to number one the first week.
Wow.
And that was because, I think, as much as anything, Doug had decided at that stage that the only way we're going to take New Zealand music, you know, further is to make records that were good enough to take internationally. So you start spending money on records. So you had these Midnight to Dawn things going on, which were the garage bands and the, you know, that, all that sort of stuff was happening. But then he said, well, you've had these, like these hit records, like the one you just heard before, and but what are you going to do with the Screaming Mimes and Blam 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 and bands like that? And I said, well, I got no money. You know, we can only afford these Midnight to Dawn things. And he said, don't worry about it.
Oh, like, wow.
We'll advance you the money to go into the studio in the daytime and you pay it off out of sales. And it got a bit more complex that later on, which I won't go into right now. But what happened in 1981, 82 was Harlequin started spending money and time and intentionally on trying to turn these records into records we could take to the rest of the world. What we kind of didn't realize at the time was the rest of the world was quite happy to listen to some of these garage band records. So, but we're all, you know, we were sitting in New Zealand right now. And we had things like early U2 records and Devo and Cars and stuff coming at us. And we thought, you know, we want to break into that market.
Mm.
And Doug was like, the only way we can do that is by making records that are that quality.
Right.
Which was, and Flying Nun kind of later proved he didn't have to have records that were made that well, but, you know, that's another whole story. So anyway, we and people like Dave Dobbin and, you know, so the Blams and stuff started making these, like, expensive records, if you want, of a better word, but records that sounded like they were produced. So the next track is a track off the Blams album, which Luxury Length, which was recorded as part of that and produced by Paul Streetsco, who's one of the engineers there, and the band, and Doug Rogers. So I thought that was kind of an appropriate record to play next.
Yeah, I reckon.
Don't Find It, Marsha by Blam Blam Blam.
To be be. But I'd rather that you were still with me. Perhaps we can arrange something. Arrange something.
I can definitely feel it leaning more slick.
Yeah, I mean, it's still blam, 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 and it's still, you know, Don McGlashan and stuff like that, but it had that sort of, a little bit of, I don't know, slick is probably the right word.
Hmm.
It was pretty, yeah. And that kind of leads on to where the story flows from there, because
mm-hmm.
it was kind of getting slicker, and the mid-80s in particular, globally, the sounds got a lot slicker, as everyone knows. I mean, 80s production is notorious. And the Doug's next idea was to try and make records that would fit into that 80s big American sort of sound. So he went out there, and he there was a thing going around in the mid-1980s. It was just like, for want of a better phrase, a tax dodge going on, whereby you could raise money in New Zealand. There was something in the law which went back to about 1905 or something, and if you raised money for artistic projects, you could write it off against your tax. So people were putting up these prospectuses. The film industry in particular was doing a lot of this stuff. You put out a prospectus and you'd say to people, right, invest your savings or whatever into this thing, and you can write off, I think it was like 150% of what you've put into it against your tax.
Wow.
So people were actually making money out of it. It was a crazy thing. So they went out there, and the film industry had been doing this for about 3 or 4 years, and the IRD hadn't really caught on to it. So Doug thought, well, if the film industry can do it, I can do it with the music industry, because it's a creative thing. So they set up a thing, him and an accountant and a bank set up a thing called Spinifex, and sent a prospectus out and said, we're going to make, I think it was 6 albums was the original plan. We'll sign 3 artists and make 2 albums by each artist and sell them into America. And this is how much money we're going to make when we sell 1 million copies of each record in America. And this is how much tax you won't have to pay to the investors and all this sort of stuff.
Wow.
I've actually got the original prospectus sitting beside me here. But so they did this thing, and they set up these things, and they signed 3 bands to a new record label he'd set up called Zulu Records. One was a guy called Roy Phillips, who was an English musician who'd moved to New Zealand, had some hits in the 1960s and early 1970s. One was Hello Sailor, and the third one was the Dance Exponents. And they made 3 albums. They raised all this money. They made 3 albums. The Roy Phillips one never got released for a variety of reasons, mainly because I don't think Doug thought it was good enough. The Hello Sailor one was called ship-shaped Bristol fashion, and it's widely regarded as the worst thing they ever did. It was like there were all sorts of crazy synths going on and drum machines and overproduction and stuff, and it cost a fortune. And the best of the lot was the Dance Exponents album, which was called Amplifier.
Classic.
And the Dance Exponents album was a bit of a flop. It had one big hit single, which is the one we're going to play at some stage soon, mm-hmm. which is kind of like Skies. And the Hello Sailor album was a complete disaster. And Roy Phillips didn't get released. And so the whole thing kind of fell over. The Inland Revenue then turned around and said, "We've had a look into this whole project, and we don't think it's legal now."
Oh, so no.
They shut the whole thing down.
Oh, and the albums didn't even do well.
Well, CBS in America, who had previously committed, heard the Hello Sailor album and said, "Nah, we're not releasing it." The Dance Exponents, yeah, the album did okay, but it didn't do as well as their previous big hit records with Victoria and stuff. Mm. The Roy Phillips didn't get released. And so what followed almost immediately afterwards was that the landlords at Harlequin said, we want to kill the lease, throw you out, and we're going to put a 60-story tower in there.
Oh.
And there was a long court battle that lasted about 2 or 3 years, and eventually Doug got paid out and he moved to Los Angeles. He took the money and disappeared to Los Angeles, which is the next part of the story. But the Dance Exponents had a single that was released, which was Caroline Skies. And I don't know if we want to play it now or after we finish the rest of the story.
We've got a little bit of time to finish the rest of the story, and then we'll play it out with Caroline Skies. How about that?
Okay, sounds good. So anyway, Doug went to America and he moved to Los Angeles and got himself a job. He won a court case against the finance company, which I think was Chase Corporation. And they paid him quite a lot of money. They knocked the building down. The building's still at that car park in Victoria Street West, with the bungee jump.
Mm-hmm.
That was where Harlequin was.
Oh, and
the
building
got built because the stock market crash came along. And it's been a car park ever since. So we lost the studio. We got a car park. Doug moved to America, got a job working in a recording studio. But the last thing he recorded in New Zealand was an album by a band called The Fan Club. And he went to America and he was mixing it in the States in the studio. And he realized he'd left behind a tape reel of drum sounds and things he wanted to use. So he had to go and recreate this sort of resample all these things. And this is when sampling was a brand new technology. So he went out there and he sampled all these sounds again and made up a reel, and he thought, well, if I'm doing this, surely other producers might be keen on having these this library of sounds. So he went to a CD pressing plant and he pressed up a couple of hundred CDs of all these sounds, and took them down to a music shop in Sunset, in LA, and said, I've got this box of CDs. Can I stick them on the counter and see if anyone else is interested? And the guy said, yeah, sure. And I'd come back in a week and pick up what's left. He got home, he drove home, and the guy rang him up literally as he walked in the door and said, you know, that box, they've all gone.
Wow.
And have you got any more? So he kind of realized he was onto something new.
Amazing.
And in the next decade or so, well, then he thought, well, I can do, you know, this is a business, I can do this. So he rang up a guy called Bob Clearmountain, who was one of America's top engineers. He still is in Connecticut, I think. And said, what are you doing this weekend? He'd never met this guy before. And the guy said nothing. And he said, well, I've got this idea. Let's do this CD. Because he kind of realized that having Bob's name on the front cover was going to sell. So he and Bob Clearmountain made the first ever drum sample CD one weekend in late 1989, and then took it to retail, basically.
Amazing. And it's just one project to the next, isn't it?
Yeah. And that was the beginning of East West Sounds, which is now, it's the second biggest sound library in the world. And he's got, I think, 42,000 sounds on the in the library. And in 2017, up until then, you had to buy subscriptions. In 2017, he thought, well, why don't I turn it into a Spotify type thing where you can subscribe?
Mm.
He did that. And now there are 300,000 musicians around the world that subscribe every month to what he's got.
I mean, it's a pretty remarkable story, and it's pretty amazing that through all the success of these various projects, he continues to sort of have that mindset of how can I contribute to emerging producers and artists, and how can I help lift them up with me as I progress on the journey. Yeah.
And, I mean, one of his projects right now is going through and trying to find missing New Zealand master tapes. Because he did all the stuff all through the years, and so much of our stuff in New Zealand is gone over the years. We were very, very, we were useless basically in preserving our masters. So, I mean, all the PolyGram and EMI stuff from the 60s, 70s, 80s through to the 90s is gone.
Yeah.
And, you know, we can't, doing these reissues, which we'd love to see, is very, very difficult without finding the original masters or having to burn off a good copy of the record. So Doug's got this like passion. He's got money, and he's got time, and he's got these facilities now, and these amazing facilities. And he's using that to try and hunt around New Zealand to find copies of these tapes which he can preserve.
Mm.
So yeah, it's like giving back.
Incredible. Now, it's such a huge story that we've just about run out of time, and I'm sure there's so many details that we haven't even covered, but I think we should listen to this track from the Dance Exponents, Caroline Skies, to close us out. Thank you so much, Simon Gregg, for chatting to us today for Audio Culture about Doug Rogers. Everybody should head over to the Audio Culture Iwi Waiata website and read the 5-part series on this incredible man and his expansive career across New Zealand music. Thank you so much,
you,
Simon.
Very much appreciated.
Have a good rest of your evening. Ka kite.
Okay. Bye. Drive. Now there's 3 in the front and there's 4 in the back. And we talk about last Friday, like who is with who and what did he say? Well, we don't really care anyway. I hear the music inside.
was
Audio Culture on 95BFM.
Thanks to Audio Culture, Iwi Waiata, the Noisy Library of New Zealand Music. Go to audioculture.co.nz. It's just fascination.